Now stay tuned for the Sunday Morning Wake Up Call on 97.9 The Wren. The Wake Up Call talks with the people in Charlottesville and Albemarle County who are making a difference. Now here's your host, Rick Moore.
And welcome back, everybody, for another Sunday Morning Wake Up Call. Today, a very informative, fun conversation. Our guest today, Harriet Kaur. She's the executive director of both the Charlottesville and Richmond offices for the International Rescue Committee. Good morning, Harriet.
Good morning, Rick.
You know, I always second guess myself, Harriet Kaur.
Yeah, you get bonus points for that. That's exactly right.
Well, I always imagine myself with a beer.
Yes, exactly right.
So the executive director, two separate offices now. We've been here doing this long enough. You've been on the show a couple times before. When the International Rescue Committee first had an office in Charlottesville, and in the last few years has added a Richmond office as well, correct?
That's correct. That's right. Yeah, Richmond is it's technically our sub office.
A sub office.
But they're growing quickly, so they're doing really good work down there.
So we'll try not to make them feel like the lesser evil twin some way.
It's usually the opposite way, so we think it's all fair in the end.
Oh, good. So for a lot of folks, we shouldn't have faith and feeling that a lot of folks know exactly what the International Rescue Committee is, the IRC, for those of us who've been in Charlottesville long enough to hear, oh, the IRC did this or is doing that. So tell us, what does the IRC do, both its overall organization and then we'll get into a little bit to the Charlottesville and Richmond offices, but a touch on that as a smaller mission as well.
So the International Rescue Committee at the top level, we're an international humanitarian aid organization. We're headquartered in New York, but we operate in about 40 countries around the world. And then we've got about 25 offices across the U.S. So we're, you know, this kind of work we're doing here in the U.S. is actually the smaller part of what IRC does at a global level. We're really present and active in a lot of countries that are experiencing, you know, displacement through conflict or sometimes natural disaster and other kind of things. And then we're also been expanding programs in Europe, some of the European countries that are also working with refugees coming in and doing something that's similar to what we do here in the U.S. So yeah, that's the IRC. And then our work in the U.S. Is all focused on refugee resettlement and then the programs that kind of expand upon that and help, you know, displaced people that are coming into this country.
So when you talk about refugee resettlement, mm-hmm. please explain to me and to our listeners how that is different, or is it different in any way from helping folks who sneak across the border? Because that's currently part of an ongoing conversation in today's culture. We have people sneaking across the border. Is the IRC helping them as refugee resettlement?
Mm-hmm. So when we talk about the refugee resettlement program, it's an organized government program. It's run by the U.S. State Department. And so refugee admissions were, like, when we use that term refugee, to us, that it actually has a very formal meaning. And it's actually an admission status to the United States. You're admitted as a refugee. And the way it works is you have to meet a certain criterion, mostly run you know, the United Nations Office for Refugees, the refugee agency kind of establishes that, and it's also established in international law and U.S. law, but it's someone who has a well-founded fear of persecution. So people who come through the organized U.S.-sponsored refugee admissions program have been displaced overseas. They've gone through a lot of screening processes, application processes, just, you know, a whole lot of vetting before they ever come into the U.S. They come in on this special status, and then they have to be resettled by a nonprofit agency. IRC is one of nine national networks that operate in the U.S. that handle refugee resettlement. But someone can't just come in as a refugee. Like, you actually have to come in and be sponsored through an agency that handles your process when you get here. To kind of make the difference between other things, there's also people who apply for and receive asylum in the U.S. And someone who is approved for asylum, it follows very similar criteria. Again, it's someone who can make a claim that they have a well-founded fear of persecution and that their lives would be in danger if they return to their home country. We actually can also serve those people. We don't bring them in the same way, but if they are here and they've been granted that status, they can come into our office and get assistance. The terms we use for people like at the border, and those kind of, we call them asylum seekers. That's how we differentiate in our terminology, but meaning people who are coming to the U.S. who may fit those criteria. They may actually, you know, be in danger, or they may be coming for economic or other reasons, but theoretically at least have the right to come to the U.S., request asylum, and have the right to apply and to go through that system to see whether or not they qualify. Does that make sense?
Yes, it does.
Yeah.
And I hope it does to the listeners as well, as we talk with Harriet Kaur. She's the executive director, Charlottesville and Richmond offices for the International Rescue Committee.
You know, Rick, I would add that our IRC, it's in some locations, is doing programming for asylum seekers, providing some transit shelter services and things like that, always in, you know, kind of an organized setting. And we have some people working on the Mexico border. So there are, within the organization, some programs working in that space, but it's in the U.S., that's not the main thrust of our work at this time.
Harriet, I don't want to get into the number of asylum seekers or and refugees, because that's a little bit later in the program. But can you give me some numbers from the mission and the work being done that are just going to make my eyes pop wide open in surprise?
The problem is that the numbers are so big now, I think it's almost impossible for people to wrap their heads around it. So, you know, like, according to the UN, there's almost 80 million people in the US, in the world. There's almost 80 million people in the world who are forcibly displaced. And that's like such a large number, it almost becomes meaningless. But
can I ask real quick?
Yeah.
When you say forcibly displaced,
right, meaning that they have had to leave their homes and that they cannot safely return, usually because of war or or some kind of armed conflict. So we're not talking about people who, you know, that it may be like a famine or something like that. This is people who cannot, if they return to their home, they could be killed, right? They're it's not safe. So they can't, you know, they've been forcibly displaced. But if you convert that, it means like one out of every 100 people have been forced from their homes. And like, you know, if you put it across the face of the earth, one out of every 100 people have been forced away from their homes and cannot safely return. So I think that's maybe a little bit more manageable. And of course, there's not very many, you know, it's not happening here. So then try and think in some other places. And out of that 80 million, actually the majority of them are displaced within their own country. They've just been, you know, one part of the country might be in conflict and then they've been pushed into other regions or other areas of the country. But out of that 80 million, the number that we call refugees is about 26 million. And those are the people that have actually completely fled their country. So they've had to cross a border. So, the other piece that to be a refugee, in order to be considered a refugee and actually come under whatever protection there is of the UN, you have to cross an international border and have fled into another country. And those are the refugees. So out of this, there's, you know, that also includes, so the majority are actually what we call internally displaced people, mean they're still within their home country, but the refugees have fled into another country and cannot return to the, you know, their own country.
International Rescue Committee has been around for how long now?
1933, we were founded. So we've been around a long time.
87 years?
Yeah, you're that sounds about
my math?
Right. Yeah. So, we were founded in 1933, actually at the request of Albert Einstein, obviously to bring people out of Europe before the Second World War, or what became the Second World War. So we were there then. We've, you know, gotten people through the, you know, coming out of Hungary and the, and then more recently, like the Balkans. So there's always something going on. But the thing that's really difficult now is a couple of years ago, I used to say that we now have the largest number of displaced people since World War II, but now we've even surpassed what happened in the Second World War. So it's kind of the largest number of forcibly displaced people in the world right now, you know, since it was being tracked, kind of.
Harriet Kaur is our guest today from the International Rescue Committee. Harriet, so here's a question. 87 years now, International Rescue Committee. I'm not suggesting that you've been with the company, with the organization that long, but how have the types of crises changed since the founding 87 years ago? Or have they?
I'm not sure they have that much, but obviously that's an interesting question. That's a really interesting question. I mean war and that kind of war displacement has been with us for a long time. Religious conflict and ethnic conflict have been with us for a long time. I think what's happening now is it's just sort of crisis upon crisis and things, you know, situations that seem, you know, unresolvable. I mean, Afghanistan or Syria, Iraq, you know, they seem difficult to resolve, don't they? Yeah, and then there's kind of issues of how to resolve that, how to, you know, because I think that the key thing I think that's really important to keep in mind, at least for what we're doing in the U.S., is, and I think a lot of Americans think that everyone wants to come to America, or, you know, to Europe or something, but most of the refugees who become displaced, all they want to do is go back home. They just want their home to be a safe place to go. And, you know, it's just so difficult to resolve some of these situations. It does happen. I mean, there are situations where people are eventually able to return home, and that's really what they want. But so many of them, they drag on so long. And, you know, after a whole generation has turned, it's really hard to send people back. They've lost their contacts and everything. Just stuff is so protracted. I'm not the foreign diplomacy person to necessarily kind of look at that on a historic scale, but yeah, that's a really good question.
So can you take me through a process if I were, hope to never be, someone leaving one situation? Mm-hmm. If I were someone outside of the U.S. and hoping and wanting or needing to be and eventually getting to Charlottesville through the IRC?
So the first thing to know is that that would take you a very long time. Because I also think that's the other thing that people think, oh, like somebody runs away and like a year later they're here, and it's not. I think the average time of displacement before someone is ever safely resettled is about 17 years. And obviously there's situations where it happens quicker. There's, you know, others where it takes much, much longer. Gosh, when I first came to Charlottesville, one of the groups we were working with were Bhutanese refugees who had, is an entire ethnic group that had been pushed out of Bhutan and back into refugee camps in Nepal. And they had been in those camps for like over 20 years before anybody ever offered them the opportunity to be resettled somewhere else. So for a lot of people, it's a really long process. And then the other thing that's important to remember is that even out of all those like 26 million refugees, probably only 1% will ever get the opportunity to resettle in another country. The rest of them are just going to stay in those camps like indefinitely or forever. So it's really a tiny group that have that opportunity. So I think typically, you know, we're working with people who've been displaced, living in not very good situations. And by the way, not all refugees live in camps. More of them actually live in urban situations than actually in organized, or as organized as they are, but in organized camps, you know, kind of living often kind of like undocumented people live in this country, you know, at the margins, being paid in cash, not, you know, having no guaranteed safety or access to healthcare or anything else. You know, just crowded into places that they at least have a roof over their heads. So what usually when people get displaced in those situations, they there are other ways, but typically they would go and register with United Nations just to have a registry, and that's kind of starts their case. And then there is just this very long vetting process that they go through. I mean, starting with, you know, an initial interview where they kind of make their refugee claim, and the UN does that first pass, like, are they actually a refugee or are they just a migrant, but someone like, can we verify that this is a persecution claim? Is it a verifiable claim? Is it a credible claim? So, you know, there's that just to even see if you're eligible to get into the program. And then there's kind of what happens after that. So I don't know if we want to pick that up.
Let's take a break.
Yeah.
And we'll come back, because it sounds like at that point, after a long time in waiting, they haven't even started any paperwork.
Not a whole lot. They might have a little card with a case number on it saying that, you know, they're a case with the UN, and that's it.
Well, let's take a break. Our guest today, Harriet Kaur, executive director at our local office in Charlottesville, as well as the Richmond office, the International Rescue Committee. We're learning a lot about what goes on and their mission. We'll come right back. And thank you for being here with us today, 97.9 The Wren. And we're always glad to be back for another week and have you with us. Harriet Kaur with us today from the International Rescue Committee. And we're talking about what they do, why they're here, how they're helping everyone. And Harriet, we were talking about how someone gets from their situation as a refugee elsewhere outside of the United States, not always overseas. And they had gotten a card with their case number after multiple years, but that's all that had happened.
Yeah, it's and they wait and wait and wait and wait for a very long time. But I, at some point, hopefully they, kind of depending on their situation, if they're especially vulnerable, whatever, they might kind of make it to the front of the line where they would be offered a chance to go to another country. We call it third country resettlement because their first country is their home. Their second country is where they ended up, like in flight, in their asylum. That's considered their country of asylum. And then they're offered permanent resettlement in a third country, which it could be the U.S., it could be Europe, it could be Australia has a big program. So it could be one of those. They're never forced to go. It's always an offer. Would you like to accept this opportunity to apply to the U.S. Refugee Admissions Program? And then once they start that, all this kind of vetting starts at a very intensive level. It takes probably, and all this happens while they're still overseas, but it's probably another 18 to 24 months just of medical clearances. They have to tell their story, you know, and give all this documentation, all their relatives, where they were, with the increased vetting from certain people coming from certain countries. Now they have to like give access to their Facebook pages, their social media. There's a whole lot of security clearances that go on, with all different kinds of U.S. and international security agencies. So it's this very long and intense vetting process. You know, one of the other things that happens for people coming to the U.S. is that they have to actually have a face-to-face interview with a representative from Department of Homeland Security. So it's not only what's going on overseas, but like someone from our Homeland Security has to go over to whatever country they're in. And every single refugee family has an interview with a specially trained person. So like the kind of review and scrutiny is quite intense. It takes a very long time. And it's only at that point that they then kind of get referred to a resettlement agency like the IRC. And then kind of assigned to a local office, like to come to Charlottesville. So, and then hopefully scheduled to travel and actually arrive. So by the time they get here, first of all, like we always like to say that they won the lottery just to get the chance to come. But they've been through quite a lot of bureaucracy and red tape to get here.
Again, our guest today, Harriet Kaur with the International Rescue Committee. Harriet, you mentioned a couple times now about the large numbers who have made an effort to resettle and the case numbers. So we'll get into that a little later in the program. And the numbers that are allowed in the U.S., I want to make sure we talk about the different platforms of the candidates. And I learned a little bit about the refugee cap. Mm-hmm. By the way, you can go to rescue.org to read some of these things yourself on the International Rescue Committee website. But it was also interesting to read about some of the more prominent people in the U.S. who've first came in as refugees.
Yeah, there's a lot of talent that came to us that way. you know.
Can you tell me about a few? Tell some of the listeners.
Well, obviously, we always like to talk about Albert Einstein, but there were, because he's kind of our guy. But Madeleine Albright came from Czechoslovakia. Her family was a refugee family. Sergey Brin, the co-founder of Google, he came as a kid, as a refugee. Gloria Estefan's family, you know, she came also as a child, but from Cuba as a refugee. Someone who has always been a really good supporter of the IRC is I'm going to blank out on his name. Oh, Andy Grove, who is the founder of Intel, one of the founders of Intel. His family were Hungarian refugees. So there's a lot of people who have come over and found their way into American life and been very, very successful. And really they're just adding tremendous amounts to the innovation and creativity and enterprise of the U.S. And I think that's just one of the things it's very short-sighted to see immigrants, especially, you know, like refugees, that they're to kind of think of them as people come in and they're just taking away from Americans. But, you know, we know like research has been done on this, and like even whatever dollars are put into some, you know, small amount into the initial cost of their resettlement is paid back many fold just through the taxes they pay and their and then the contributions to our economy. You know, a lot of refugees and other immigrants are, you know, end up going into starting businesses and you know, kind of really become job creators themselves. But there's just a lot of they also bring kind of new ideas and new ways of looking at the world that actually provide a lot of benefit to our country.
Well, you use the phrase taking away, and one of the comments that you can hear from folks is that there's a view that refugees are, they're job needy, and they take a lot of social service aspects, and they're just financially expensive. They take these things away from true American residents.
Yeah.
Can you comment on that?
I don't agree with it, but I think this kind of idea that somehow economics is a zero sum game, you know, like there's only so many pieces of the pie is really, really not the right way to look for it. I would say a couple things. One is, I think when people first come, I mean, traditionally, and truthfully, I think it's true here in Charlottesville, when people first come to us, a lot of the jobs they're going into are the jobs that Americans don't really want. You know, I always like, I'm not sure I always understand it, because it's like, why would someone hire a refugee if they can find someone who speaks really great English and, you know, is a native born American, like who could do that job as well or better? I think a lot of times people are kind of filling these jobs that are high turnover, and the refugees often are, you know, a lot steadier employees because they need that job. They need to support their family. You know, they don't have those, you know, when they're just first coming, they don't have, you know, family networks or relatives they can go live with or something. They have to pay the rent. And, you know, when people are coming like to Charlottesville, we're putting them in regular, you know, they're not in any kind of subsidized housing or anything. They have to get out and earn money. And from IRC, like our job, like our expectation, the expectation on us is, you know, we're supposed to have these refugee families with enough people in the family employed, earning enough income to cover their basic expenses like rent and utilities and food and whatever they need, they're supposed to be there within like 4 to 6 months of arrival. It's a really tight time frame. And you know, we know in Charlottesville, like, okay, and we're not going to talk about the COVID period, but in general, about 80% of our families meet that, you know, 80 to 85% of the families meet that mark. So they're coming to this country and very quickly becoming self-sufficient. And I don't know. You tell me, like, you know, the lines of people to do like housekeeping jobs or, you know, a lot of the jobs that are often the first jobs that we're putting people into because they have to go to work quickly. I mean, that doesn't mean that that's where we expect them to stay, you know, but oftentimes we're just pushing them into kind of a first job just because they have to make enough money to pay the rent. And then hopefully after they're here, they'll move back up. But I think if you talk to employers, if you know, you could go around and talk to employers around town, but there are definitely categories of job where they actually have trouble keeping a workforce.
Well, you talk about, again, our guest today, Harriet Kaur, executive director for the Charlottesville and Richmond offices at the International Rescue Committee, as we talk about the mission and the tasks being done and the asylum seekers and refugees that are coming through that the IRC is assisting. You talk about finding jobs for these refugees. And I've been doing this radio show for 20 plus years now. I've met a wide variety of folks, and whether meeting people who know people, businesses, I've done a show several times now with the Charlottesville Community Investment Collaborative, which helps entrepreneurs start their own business. And I've met some folks, some refugees, a little bit down the road who are starting their own business. And a phrase that comes to mind when I talk about IRC refugees is frequently underemployed.
Yes. Yeah. Yes. That's true. It's tough.
Can you define that term as you talk about it?
I think it's kind of a tough thing for us because, you know, in some other countries that resettle refugees, they might offer them like a year of support, you know, so they can like learn the language. And but the U.S. is, you know, we actually don't do that in the U.S. Like the time frame when we actually have funding to kind of help people with their expenses is really short. It's just a few months. So we really need people to get into jobs and, you know, regardless of their English language abilities or, you know, where they came from. So we do tend to kind of push people into these entry level jobs when they first come. And then what we hope and what we've been putting a lot of effort into is getting them to come back, you know, a year down the road when their English is improved and let us help them start moving up that job ladder. But it is true that, you know, and when we say refugee, I think a lot of times like people have this like picture that pops in their mind of like some uneducated, illiterate person in a camp, you know, behind barbed wire. But we get everything, right? When the bombs start falling, everybody runs. And we definitely have people with, you know, low education skills. And then we have everything up to, you know, we have medical doctors who are refugees. We had an airplane pilot once, you know, and engineers and everything in between. So the goal is to kind of help the family at least get on its feet, make sure that they can pay their rent, cover their expenses, and then try to figure out how to, you know, anybody that has an education, has skills, has other, you know, whatever professional credentials they have, try and figure out then how to get them back working at that level. But that it takes time because, you know, they do have to have language skills. And even people who come, speaking English, their written skills may not be at the same level, and that may be required for a job. You may have to be able to write reports or things like that. But we work with them, and we've got people here now that are working in accounting and engineering firms and different things like that. But it takes a little while, but that's, we want to help them. Like, that's the road we want to be walking with them, along with them, to get them there. And so, you know, we've got people, we've also been working with people to get them back into skill training courses, like at PVCC, stuff like that. So we've had people do the truck driving course. We have a lot of people that go through CNA, certified nursing assistant courses, or other kinds of allied health. You know, there's just a lot of work just trying to find the right fit for each person and then support them. You know, and the other thing is, like, that you made reference to, I think, starting small businesses. You know, there was a couple years ago, someone did a study across the whole state of Virginia and, you know, figured out that immigrants start businesses at a greater rate than native born Americans. I think probably for two reasons. One is, a lot of them had businesses where they came from. We have a lot of people that had shops or restaurants or whatever, different kinds of things where they came from, and that's what they know. But I think also, because it's so much harder for them to work their way into traditional careers, I think a lot of times just starting their own business is a strong alternative for someone who's ambitious and entrepreneurial. But it's interesting. Yeah. And I agree with you. I absolutely agree with you. People are underemployed, and that's something that we really want to help them with.
Again, our guest today is Harriet Kaur. She's with the International Rescue Committee as we talk about their mission and the refugees. And we're going to take a break. And when we come back, we're going to get into the 2020 election in terms of some of the platform, some of the numbers and way things are being done now under the current administration, and whether or not the opposing candidate has taken the time to put forth any numbers out there on his own. So we'll be right back. And thank you for being with us today. And as always, thank you to the Wren for making a space for us here on Sunday mornings for the Wake Up Call. And thanks to Harriet Kaur joining us on a Sunday morning as we talk about the International Rescue Committee. Harriet, can you inform us a little bit as we try and learn a little bit before the upcoming final election day for those who are still planning their vote? Who decides how many refugees can come into the U.S.?
Mm-hmm. So, the refugee program in the U.S. as we know it kind of comes from the Refugee Act of 1980. That was when legislation was passed to kind of organize and standardize how the process works. And the process puts the actual the number of refugees admitted each year is by presidential determination. It's actually an executive order that is to be signed each year by the president. The legislation is very specific. It's supposed to happen as part of consultations. There's supposed to be consultations between the State Department and Congress and the White House. And they're supposed to kind of consult, look at what is the situation in the world, what is going on with displacement, where's the greatest need. And then with that, come up with a number that seems correct or appropriate to meet the need for that year. But it does have to be, you know, signed every year. So typically they would agree on a target number. It's a ceiling, not a floor. It's like the maximum number of refugees that can be admitted each year. And then hopefully by the end of the federal fiscal year, like by the end of September, the president would sign that. So right now obviously we're already into October. We're into a new year. the president has not yet signed the presidential determination for this year. So actually no refugees can enter right now until that.
Wait.
Yeah.
We're in October of 2020.
Yeah.
And no, and the determination for 2020 has not been signed. So no refugees for 2020 have entered yet.
So this is federal fiscal year, right? So it's the new year that starts October 1.
Okay.
Not a calendar year, right? So the hope, yeah. So, but once we go into, so we're now in federal fiscal year 2021. So, but after October 1, but yes, so actually no refugees can enter the U.S. until the president signs that determination. So yeah, we're waiting. And we, I think that the consultations, the required consultations happened last week. So
what happens if, and I'm not picking candidates, I'm right. just playing the game here.
Right.
If our current president chooses to sign the document on January 1st, does that mean, because it doesn't matter whether he wins or loses, if he decides to sign a document with whatever numbers are chosen on January 1st, does that mean that zero refugees could have entered for 3 out of the 12 months?
Yes. That's never happened that long, but
lots of things have never happened under the current president.
I think last year the president actually signed like at the beginning of November.
So let's say that this president loses the election. Is it still his document to sign, and that he can sign it on January 1st or November 10th or whenever? But if he can, he still sign it after the election, after election day, or I'll say election determination day. Can he still sign a document with numbers?
Sure. I mean, you're getting that's kind of like way into scenarios, but I mean, it is an executive order, and the expectation is that the president would sign it for the new fiscal year. It has not yet happened. I can't predict when it would happen. It would be very unusual for it to go on that long, but who knows? But what I can tell you is, so obviously in the last couple of years, that number, the number has been going down. I think the lowest number we ever really saw by any president, and it's important to remember that traditionally refugee resettlement has been a bipartisan issue. It has been strongly supported by administrations of any stripe or variety. I think probably the lowest number ever authorized before the current administration was about 60,000. I think 1 year Reagan authorized 60,000. President Obama, in his last, in a September of his last year in office, authorized 110,000. He actually signed a presidential determination for 110,000 in an attempt to respond to the crisis, the Syrian refugee crisis. And that's how we went into the election. President Trump in the, kind of first executive order on immigration, then one of the parts of that was to reduce that down to like 50,000, and then it's been reduced. So in the year that just ended, the presidential determination was for 18,000 refugees. And each year that has been the lowest number ever since 1980. So the number that is being floated for this year that we believe is what would be authorized is 15,000. So even further reduction. So again, the lowest number since 1980. So
do we know what President Bush No, just to have a comparison of the most recent Republican president.
I don't remember the exact number. I can probably look it up. But like President Bush, even after 9/11, still signed a presidential determination for a significant, you know, a very large number. Or a typical number. He went ahead and signed that even after 9/11. Now, the thing is, you know, that's a ceiling. It doesn't mean that many people come in. And in fact, after 9/11, the program was frozen or reduced, and not that many people came in for a while. But the thing is, the intent was still there, meaning if there are people and we think they're safe and we can safely bring the U.S., yes, it's okay. So it doesn't mean that exactly that number of people enter. And in fact, like in the year that just ended, that determination was for 18,000. 18,000 refugees didn't enter. The number was, through different circumstances, was much lower.
Has candidate Biden spoken about the refugee cap?
He has. I think in the platform, he's citing a number of 125,000.
But again, you say that this is a ceiling, right? And unless he has the people in the infrastructure to allow a lot more folks through the system,
yeah,
that will never get that many folks in.
Well, just for that year, but it is, I mean, obviously the refugee resettlement system has been constrained over the last few years. We've lost offices, we've lost staff, there's capacity in the network. I think IRC has fought very hard to keep our offices in a strong position, but it's been a lot of work to do that. Obviously, you know, there's still a lot of work to kind of develop that capacity. And obviously, we also, each office, like my office here, you know, in Charlottesville or in Richmond, we have an obligation to work with the community. We can't just bring in like a ton of refugees and dump them, right? So we're also have to make sure we're working with numbers that are, you know, the community has adequate housing, that there are jobs, that our partner agencies can provide services at that level. So there's always like kind of this give and take and making sure that everything's right. I don't think that that's a number that would happen right away, but it's not to say that that's not a number that over a couple of years we could work back up to, and, you know, and always making sure that that our partners are with us and that we can safely and properly resettle that number of people. But no, why not? I mean, it's kind of hard to remember, but when like back in the 70s and stuff, like when the U.S. was receiving refugees from Indochina, like Vietnamese, the Cambodians, the Laotians, and people kind of from that period, there were very large numbers of people entering the U.S. It was well over 100,000 people a year. And we forget that. That was like so long ago, and there was a lot of opposition to that. And now those people are very deeply woven into the fabric of our communities.
One thing I read, again, rescue.org for the International Rescue Committee website, was that it wasn't just the number of refugees that made up part of the refugee cap, but also one of the changes that had been made was that it's, I guess, I don't know the proper way to phrase it,
other than
who was allowed.
Yes, it's completely, it's been completely changed in a way never done before.
It's not just, the vulnerability. It's whether or not the U.S. finds you, right, whether or not the U.S. finds you helpful to the U.S.?
Yes, yeah, which is not what the refugee resettlement program, we're not saying that that's the way all immigrants should be entering the U.S., but it is, it's a humanitarian, life-saving humanitarian program, right? It's for the most vulnerable people that have no chance of making a life for themselves where they are. And obviously, yeah. And so it has a different purpose. It's not like it's not the whole framework of immigration, but it is its own, important thing. And I think most Americans, I would like to think that most Americans say, you know, it's not, you don't do it because it like make, you know, it's like, we're not doing it because it's great for America, even though we think it is, but we're also doing it because it's the right thing to do. And we're Americans and we want to help out, you know, the less fortunate people in the world, that's who we are. There's that.
Can you tell me, but tell me how these folks are vetted,
yeah,
I guess is the word I'll use, because if I'm going to be on the side of allowing, whether it's 15,000, 45,000, or 110,000 people into the country, who I don't want to be the neighbor who's looking over my shoulder, but I do want to be the neighbor who's thankful to have them to cut my grass, run my grocery counter, or go to their restaurant, or have them as my doctor. Make me comfortable.
Well, I think I kind of covered that a little bit, because it is, you know, the vetting for refugees is at a much higher level than any other category of immigrants. They're the most examined, checked, and verified category of immigrants to enter the U.S. Because we talked about kind of that 18 to 24 month period of going through everything, all these different kind of background checks, security checks. And then...
Then why is the number going down?
So it has nothing to do with that. I don't think it really has much to do with that, because when we say only 1% of refugees, like even if we say we're going to admit fewer from, you know, this country or that country, there's always another country. But so traditionally, until the current administration, like when you set that refugee cap, the ceiling of people that can come in a given year, it was always divided geographically. And it was actually by looking at conflict areas and need and where people were displaced. And they would say, okay, you know, this many from, you know, Africa, this many from Asia, you know, kind of, and it was just regionally divided. And during the current administration, it's being handled in a different way, which is by categories, and it's, you know, a category for religious minorities. There's a category for a very small number of people coming out of Central America as refugees. And it kind of like these different things. And then the category that's like for everybody else is minuscule. So for example, one of the groups that, and when you're kind of doing this work, like I am, like you, kind of where people are coming from, actually, you know, over a period of time, it changes. Like, cause we might, you know, say, well, there's all these Bhutanese refugees or Burmese refugees. And we kind of, they usually have like kind of a 5 or 6 year period, and you resettle them. And then they don't get to keep coming forever. They're given a window of opportunity to accept, you know, or to apply. And if they miss it, they're out of luck. So you kind of work through different populations. But for example, the population, I mean, besides, you know, the Syrians and people in the Middle East, a population in great need right now are Congolese. They're, you know, not any kind of unusual security threat. They've been displaced for a very, very long time. But in this current system, there's, and especially like for this year, there's basically nothing left for them. And kind of, so it's been set by these categories of preference that leaves out the people with the most need, but it also kind of is so limiting that it almost guarantees that there's no way you could even reach that ceiling. So it's kind of trying to use the refugee system. That's not its purpose, right? There are other immigrants where we might favor people with certain professions or experience, but it, like putting that on people who are kind of fleeing for their lives, but that they should also like have this or that special need is it's a lot. It's a lot. And it's, yeah, it's really tough.
So, Harriet, we just got 2 minutes left. So I would think that fundraising goes up and down as specific crises make the news. Has fundraising changed up or down since 2017 with various laws and executive orders significantly affected the refugees?
You mean like private donations from people?
Yes.
Yeah. Yes. I would say the Charlotte, I mean, I feel very fortunate because the Charlottesville community is very supportive of our work and very generous. And we have a lot of people who have supported us for a long time. I would say this year, yes and no. Obviously, like there was definitely a tick up with the Syrian crisis and a lot of people that really felt for the Syrian people, and justifiably so, and wanted to reach out in that, you know, with them. And you know, there's there's always also kind of political currents in some of that too that may favor or disfavor us. But I mean, this year it's COVID that's impacted us like other nonprofits too, because we can't do our fundraising events. It makes it a little bit harder to, we're not able to really be out meeting with people in the same way. We've had to try to find other ways, but I think that's made things tough too, a little bit tough too. But
I did see where you can go to the, you can find your way to the Charlottesville International Rescue Committee version, and there's some Amazon wish lists to help specific families.
There's that, and there is a donate button there too. But you know, yeah. But we're okay. We're doing okay. But we always can use help.
Well, that's good to know. Again, our guest today has been Harriet Kaur, Executive Director at the International Rescue Committee's Charlottesville and Richmond offices. Harriet, thanks so much for being with us. You've been in the studio in the past, and not quite the same doing it this way, but the life of COVID doesn't strike us the way it's helped hindered some of the refugees. So please go do your thing and help them out.
Thank you very much for having me. It was my pleasure.
All right. Folks, thanks for being with us. Thanks to the Wren for helping Sunday Morning Wake Up Call. We'll be here again next Sunday. Take care.
This has been the Sunday Morning Wake Up Call on Real Oldies 97.9 The Wren. The Wake Up Call is produced by Dan Gould. Show archives can be found at SeavillePodcast.com. Be sure to join Rick next Sunday morning at 11 a.m. for The Wake Up Call, only on 97.9 The Wren.